We interrupt this program to annoy you and make things generally irritating.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Chat with a Cat. This is taking place between Sims 6 and 7 of the 1981 season. In my last podcast, I talked a little bit about how I feel you can evaluate teams and kind of my general model for basketball, wherein you're either trying to push up your average efficiency, push down your opponent's average efficiency, or give yourselves more or possessions or drive your opponent's possessions down. I thought that that dovetailed nicely a little bit into talking somewhat about game planning in Fast Break. Obviously, there are some options for game planning your offense and your defense, and I thought it would be a natural subject to talk about how once you have in your head the model of efficiency and possessions for a basketball game, how that might affect the way that you choose to use pace, motion, three-pointers, and so forth. So we'll start with the obvious one, and that's three-point usage. The generally accepted truism in basketball, especially since about the mid-2010s and the rise of Golden State Warriors, has been three is better than two. There's also the often cited stat that if I can make 33% of my three-pointers and you make 50% of your two-pointers, then we are effectively shooting the same percentage. I would note that based on my last podcast and the note that generally about 75%, well, let's call it 67 to 75% of shots are rebounded by the defense. You might even consider that it doesn't quite have to be 33% because you're going to have more misses and therefore more offensive rebounds, which an offensive rebound essentially extends your possession or lets you get a redo on a possession. But yeah, let's talk about three-point usage. Obviously, it's not huge in the current state of the league. Again, going by historical standards, the three-pointer had not really been incorporated into teams' offenses yet. In fact, if you take a look at the leading three-point shooting teams in the league, right now they are the Jazz taking 4.8 per game and the 76ers taking 4.2 per game. So even if you were to shoot 50% from three-point range, you're only getting an extra 1 point compared to taking a 50% two on those shots. On average, teams are making less than 2 3-pointers a game. So cranking up the 3-point usage at this point, even if you were to double what you're getting, essentially only gets you 3 or 4 extra points over the course of an average game. Motion, again, I suspect, and I don't have anything statistically to back this up, but based on my understanding of how these games work, is if you have a team with a high average passing score, or perhaps if you have the ball, you know, probably more with your guards, which have high handling and high passing scores, setting up motion to a higher level will cause more passes and therefore more chances for an assist. And if I were modeling a basketball game, I would basically say someone with a high assist rating gives a player a chance to score a basket that is better than normal. So it essentially inflates a player's shooting percentage above what it would ordinarily be if it's a quote-unquote potential assist, because obviously every assist is dependent on another player making a made basket. Focus, I think generally this era of the league is set for inside. And also, if you look around the league, not a lot of players have good jump shooting. We talked about there's not a lot of three-pointers. I think as you get more players with high jump shooting scores and three-point shooting scores, you might see some focus become balanced or outside. But I think anytime offensively you set your focus to inside, what you are doing is you are, A, making sure you're shooting more two-pointers than threes, and B, you're relying on your player's inside shooting, which means it, at least in theory, it should be going up against your opponent's post-defense scores. Meaning, if you anticipate a lot of players that you'll be playing against to be using inside-focused offenses, you'll want to do training on your post-defense scores. And it means perimeter defense scores, which I assume take down the efficiency. Perimeter shots are not as important. Crashing the boards, I think, is self-explanatory. Usually in these simulations, there is some sort of trade-off. When you send more people to crash the defensive glass, you won't get as much transition offense. Whereas if you send a few players to crash the boards, you will get more transition offense. Some of the sims I've been in before actually had an explicit transition offense and transition defense rating. This does not. So I would assume that that probably comes out of quickness. So perhaps if you have a team that has abnormally high quickness, especially in front court spots, crashing the boards might be something you want to do a little bit less. But the real thing to talk about offense is pace. And this goes back to the discussion that I had before about, you know, efficiency per possession and number of possessions. The simple way of putting this is, let's say we have a game where I am throwing 10 dice and you are throwing 10 dice. Our odds of winning are even. Let us further assume that your efficiency is an average of, let's say, 1 point per game better than mine. And that's going to mean that on every one of those 10 die rolls, you average 0.1 more than I do. What I would like to do to maximize my chances of winning is to reduce the number of dice thrown, because the odds of me, you know, rolling, if I'm just rolling one die, rolling higher than you are a lot better than the odds of being rolling higher than you across 10 dice. If you have the statistical advantage on any given die roll. Similarly, if you feel you have the more talented team, you want more possessions, so the law of large numbers takes over, and on average, your maybe 0.1 or 0.01 advantage per possession, when you multiply it by 100 possessions, becomes an advantage of 1 or 10 or, you know, whatever it is. So generally, my recommendation would be that teams that consider themselves less talented run a slower-paced game, and teams that consider themselves more talented run a higher-paced game if you want to maximize wins. But that may not be what you're aiming to maximize. So this is one of the other considerations that comes in. One of the things that you may want to do, particularly if you have a poor team, is tank. And in that case, you want to crank the pace up, because on average, you're going to lose. Alternatively, a reason to crank the pace up is you might be trying to inflate players' numbers. We see a lot of this when people are now looking back at the numbers that Wilt Chamberlain put up, and they say, well, you know, the pace of play was a lot higher back then. There were more possessions. And if you compare it to somebody from the mid-90s where there were fewer possessions, of course, he's putting up bigger numbers because there are more points, more rebounds, and so on to be had per game. I guess, classic example of this is if you're the Suns, 7 seconds or less offense. Each one of your possessions takes only 7 seconds. You can fit a lot more of them into the game, so there's going to be more shots. That means there's going to be more rebounds. There's going to be more assists. Maybe not more blocks and steals, but you get the idea. There's opportunities to pick up more counting stats. Whereas if you're playing one of the Detroit Pistons from the 2004s, you might get a shot with 2 or 3 seconds left on the shot clock. There are fewer shots, less points, less rebounds, and so on. So if you have a player that you are trying to showcase for a trade, a high pace may be the way you want to go, even if that doesn't mean you're as likely to win. Similarly, let's talk a little bit about defense for a moment. And I've put together a post on the forums, I think it's in the archive area, that talks about the various kinds of defenses and generally how I've observed them to work. And if I remember correctly, when I went ahead and set these up, basically what I did was to test them. I made several leagues worth, I guess you could say, of players that had 50s in every attribute. And then I set every team to run the same defense except one, and then I would run 2 or 3 seasons and see how that deviated from the norm in order to work out on average what do I think is happening. And the reason I chose man-to-man defense as the baseline defense, I guess you could call it, is I think man-to-man defense would be the default essentially if whoever is matched up at the center position offensively matches up with the center position defensively, and those are the ratings that are used. And that's essentially, you know, when the game is trying to figure out, you know, when this player is trying an inside shot, what is he doing in terms of defender, you know, how good is the defender? It matches that up. And this is where, by the way, you can probably get better results in the playoffs than the regular season, because the playoffs, you generally know who you're facing. You're facing them for just two games, maybe one. And so you can kind of dictate matchups a little bit in a way you can't in the regular season, Sims, when you're playing 7-8 games a sim. And, you know, so you might want to have a particular matchup in one game, but if you do that, it screws up your matchup for the other 6 or 7. So anyway, if I assume that man defense is your baseline defense, zone defense, at least per the game, lets your players be rested. So if you have players with lower stamina scores, that might be something to pay attention to. If you've simmed the games out and kind of watched as the game goes along, players basically stay at 100% for a while, and then after they've been in, they start dropping off, you know, to 95% and 93% and 90%, 88% and 70%. And there is some percentage at which the game will sub them out where they are, I am assuming this is like 88% of what they normally are. So if you have a player with a 100 post defense, now he's really got an 88. Or once he gets down to 70, he's really got a 70. So it might be better to bring in his backup who only has a 75, but he's 100% rested, so he's going to be better. So in general, that's how you can think of it. Your stamina keeps you at 100% for a certain amount of time. I don't know what that is. I would suspect that even a player with 100 stamina can't go an entire game. And since stamina regenerates when you're on the bench, again, this is complete speculation, but this is how I model it in my head. I would think that a 100 stamina would allow a player to go for about 10 minutes continuously before needing a break. That just, it makes an easy number to me. And it lets you count, you know, 600 seconds. You know, each point of stamina lets you stay on the floor for 6 seconds before you start seeing a drop-off. And then every 6 seconds you're on the floor past your stamina rating, you start declining. That's how I see it in my head. I have no reason to believe this is how it's actually done. But just something to think about when you're setting your minutes per game. Generally, I would say 40 times your stamina divided by 100 is probably what you want to look for, unless you've got a really, really bad backup, in which case, you know, even somebody playing at 70% might be better than the backup. You know, if you're Moses Malone and your backup is, I don't know, Joe Schmo, probably want Moses playing as close to 48 minutes as possible. The problem that zone does, at least, you know, based on those trials that I did, is the opponent shoots better from the floor and turns it over less. So if you set your defense to zone, hopefully you have high steal ratings and high defensive ratings to make up for that. Otherwise, you are virtually lowering your post and perimeter defense rates and lowering your steal percentages. Help defense kind of does the opposite. It reduces field goal percentages. And the other thing with help defense is that turnovers stay about the same, but you get fewer steals, meaning you get fewer transition opportunities, fewer live balls, and so on. Also, help defense seems to result in more fouls for the helping team. And I know we've made personal foul ratings public, so if you have high personal foul ratings, help defense could be for you. If you have low ratings, help defense is probably not for you, because I think getting your players into foul trouble and giving the other team free throws probably hurts you more than dropping their field goal percentage will. Finally, half trap, I kind of describe as the risk-reward defense. It goes for steals and it limits three-point shooting. At this point in the league's history, that's probably not great. Also, if you look at the average number of steals per game. There are not a ton of them. The average team is only getting steals on about, let's see, pull the number up here. Steals leaders. Yeah, the average team is getting between 6 and 9 steals per game. So to go from the worst team in the league to the best team in the league means you're getting 3 extra steals per game. And half trap also seems to fatigue players faster. So you're going to get deeper into your bench. So again, hopefully this, you know, if you have a lot of players with a high steal rating, and I think I mentioned, I suspect it has more to do with front court steal ratings, the guys sitting in your center and power forward and small forward spot. I think that's the way to go. And then when you're looking at the usages, essentially, I think setting, you know, usage on your primary defense to 2 and your secondary defense to 1 means 1/3 of the time you're in your secondary, 2/3 of the time you're in your primary. And that doesn't change if you go 4 and 2, 6 and 3, 8 and 4. So essentially, you know, it's a, on a scale, you know, on you're splitting it up, right? If you say, I'm going to do a 10 and a 3, you have 13 possessions, and 10 of them you're going to do this, and 3 of them you're going to do that. So I think it is generally a good idea to have a secondary defense that fits the strength of maybe 1 or 2 of your players. But in general, you should probably keep your primary defense, you know, quote unquote, normal. Similarly, full court press seems to get more steals. It does wear your players down faster. It also means that you commit more fouls. So again, you know, it's a question of do you want to increase your number of possessions, possibly at the risk of increasing your number of fouls. Finally, crashing the defensive boards kind of does the same thing as crashing the offensive boards. When the offense is crashing the boards, they're not as good at getting back on defense. When the defense is crashing the boards, they're not as good at getting in transition. But especially if you have a team that shoots a low percentage, I think crashing the boards offensively is good. Similarly, if you're a high value defense in terms of limiting your opponents to low shooting, you might consider turning up your crashing the boards defensively to high, because even if you're limiting their shots, if they just get an offensive rebound, they can score it again. And I have not taken a deep dive into the box scores and the play-by-plays to see what the percentage of shots made on offensive rebounds are. But if this is modeled on the real NBA, generally the odds of making a field goal, and this is something that I've always found interesting, and you can extrapolate this not just to the NBA, but to college basketball, even high school basketball or YMCA or whatever else as well, the percentages will just be lower. I want to say NBA players on a slam dunk have about a 90-95% chance of making it. Generally, the only time you miss a slam dunk is when somebody blocks you. Layups comes in around 70. Shots within 3 feet of the rim are above 50%. And once you get to 4 feet and farther, it's about 40% in the NBA, all the way out to the three-point line, where it slowly tails off. But taking a 30-footer is, I think these days, like a 33-34% proposition. Taking a 20-footer just inside the line is a 40% shot. And that's why you've seen teams slowly work to basically everything's either a layup or a three and nothing in between. Because if you're shooting basically the same percentage from 15 to 20 feet as you are from the three-point line, there's no reason to take those shots. You may as well just take a step back and get the extra point if you make it. And when I tracked this for high school sports several years ago when my kids were in high school, obviously there aren't a lot of dunks in high school basketball, but around the rim, you know, 50 to 60% within 3-4 feet, 40-50%. Once you got outside of that, it was 20% no matter where you shot it from. So you may as well get back and take a three. So something to consider there. And then if you look at the NBA, you know, I mentioned that overall field goal percentage is in the 50s, but overall field goal percentage, at least last time I looked, on possessions that come off of an offensive rebound was something close to 70% if the shot goes up within 3 seconds of the offensive rebound. So when somebody tracks down the offensive rebound and kicks it out and restarts the offense, doesn't really give you much help. But normally when you get an offensive rebound, number one, you're close to the basket. Number two, the defense is out of position. And number three, you may be flying in for a tip dunk. So if this is doing the same modeling that the NBA stats would lead you to, offensive rebounds should be a much higher percentage shot than non-offensive rebounds. And again, I would have to do a deep dive into the box scores to see how that plays out. But again, this is just me using my knowledge of how things work in the real world and how I would try to design a sim league to simulate that. With that, we'll take a quick break while I grab a drink, and then I'll be back to kind of look at most of the teams here because this is probably the last pod that I'm going to record before we hit the trade deadline, and I'll give a little bit of advice to some teams, stand pat, make a trade, buy or sell, or whatever else.
This week on Zenora, Queen of Battle, a journey is undertaken.
Here, Janelle, we can bathe in this hot spring.
And there's room for both of us.
And Janelle is wounded.
Ow! My inner thigh!
Here, let me rub some ointment on that.
All on the next Zenora.
Thanks for calling the Movie Ending Phone. Press 1 for a brief introduction to our service. Press 2 if you know which movie you'd like to hear the ending to. Press 3 for movies near you that are almost over. We understand that you don't have time to sit in a dark movie theater with people you don't know. That's where the Movie Ending Phone comes in. Just press the number on your touchtone pad that corresponds to the movie you wish you had seen. The defendant in Primal Fear is just faking it. Why deal with high admission prices, bad popcorn, and sticky floors? Steve Buscemi ends up in a wood chipper. Why let the person next to you ruin the movie for you when you can do it yourself? The killers in Scream are the boyfriends. Let your friends talk about all the movies they want. You'll never have to cover your ears again. Kevin Spacey is Kaiser Soze. And he's the killer in Seven. The Movie Ending Phone. You'll never have to leave the house again. Darth Vader is still Luke's father.
Okay, as promised, this being the last pod I'm likely going to do before the trade deadline, which happens in two sim. Well, I guess you have one more sim, and then the trade deadline happens before the next sim is executed. But this season is a little bit different from last season in that we're seeing some separation now that we didn't have right after the creation draft when everybody was nominally on even footing. We've seen a couple of teams that have embraced the tank. We've seen several teams that are trying to go for it, and the league is striating. There are contenders, there are few teams in the middle, and there are teams that are obviously trying to build for the future. We'll start in the Eastern Conference, because if you click on the playoff standings page, they're on top. Now, I do think it's interesting that the Bullets have managed to run down the Knicks for the lead in the Atlantic after the Knicks' hot start. The Bucks, of course, are the class of the league, not just the class of the East. The Pacers, after a slow start, seem to be regaining the form that they had last season. And so I think all four of those teams are strong contenders. They're probably going to want to be buyers. I don't think there's really much reason for them to sell at this point. At the bottom, the Nets... Well, I'm not going to say the Nets, and I'll get to that in a minute. The 76ers, the Hawks, and the Pistons were bad last season. They're going to be bad this season. They're significantly under 500. They're at least 10 games under 500. And I don't think that they're going to be able to make a playoff push. So they're probably your sellers. And that leaves, kind of sitting in the middle, the Celtics, who, even though I think they have the same record as the Knicks and Pacers, the caveat I have with the Celtics is they played about 10 more games. Well, let's see, 19 and 8. That makes them 27 home games and just 16 road games. So they played 11 more games at home than on the road. So I think their record is a little bit inflated, and it will come back down as they start playing more road games. They're going to be fighting it out with the Cavaliers, the Bulls, and the Nets. So you have those four teams in the middle, Celtics, Cavs, Bulls, and Nets, that are going to be fighting for the last two playoff spots. I don't count the Nets out, even though they're seven games behind the Bulls and eight games behind the Cavaliers for the final spot, because A, they're the defending champions. We know their team's quality. And B, they've had to deal with Cliff Robinson, who last season I think was their second leading scorer, only playing 16 games so far this season. And if you take a look at the games in which he's played, the Nets are running at about 500. So I think there's time for the Nets to get things turned around. Robinson is back this week. I do think the Nets need to add a player in order to make a strong playoff push. What they give up to add that, I'm not sure. You know, I like their young core. Williams, Dawkins, Robinson, Drew are all 25 and under. I'm sure they would really love to add a center. Maybe somebody takes a flyer that they're not going to be able to get it turned around, and their first-round pick will be decent this year. But they may just want to hang on to that first-round pick in case it's pretty good this year and get another young player and add it to the stable. So the Nets are a team that I could see making a move, but I could also see them standing pat and trying to run it back next year. They're one of the few teams that isn't going to make the playoffs that you can look at and say, well, they have the pedigree, and there's a reason, and it's injuries, that they're not making the playoffs this year that will correct itself next year. You know, in theory, if the injuries don't hit them again next year, they'll have a much better squad. The Celtics, Cavaliers, and Bulls are a little more clumped together. We know the Bulls have been shopping Sven Nader and Rick Roby most of the season. I don't know how much interest they've had in them. I mean, Nader is certainly doing decent, but he's kind of fallen out of favor in terms of getting playing time in favor of Martin Webster. I don't know if that's the right call or not. I think, you know, the good news is Webster is a much better shot blocker and about the same rebounder. He's just not as offensively polished as Nader. So maybe they try to do it as a two-headed monster, but obviously, Kyle Macy is healthy this year. Michael Cooper is healthy this year. Steve Johnson, despite getting hit in training camp, has had a productive season. So I can see where Logan is trying to just kind of stay the course, believe in his team, and pick himself off the mat. That said, I do think the Bulls would be well-served to make a move for a strong starting center. And I think if they do that, they improve their chances of making the playoffs. The Cavaliers are currently sitting at 26 and 21. They're in the sixth spot. They're one game ahead of the Bulls. I think they're also a team that really could use another big man. They've been carried again this season by their guard combination of Jim Paxson and Sidney Moncrief. Rick Mahorn is doing an okay job, but they're one big away, I think, from really solidifying up their playoff standing. And then there's the Celtics, who, stop me if you've heard this before, they've got Elvin Hayes, but they still need another big man. The thing that I did not see coming, probably wouldn't have traded him, was Bernard King leading the league in scoring right now. He's averaging 36.6 a game, which is just absolutely insane. So they've definitely got a 1-2-3 punch in King, Maurice Cheeks, and Brian Winters. Again, Elvin Hayes is doing good work as he's getting older at 36. Yeah, he's putting up 21-7, 21-8. But they still need one more solid piece in the front court. I do think those three teams, the Celtics, Cavaliers, and Bulls, will be in a dogfight. I don't think the Nets have enough time left to catch up. I wouldn't put it past them. And as we saw, if the Nets can make the sixth spot, they're capable of making a finals run from the sixth spot. So if I'm the Nets, I'm watching very closely how my performance over this upcoming sim is. If I am able to close the gap on the Cavaliers, I probably am more incented to make a move. If I can't close that gap, I think I'm out of time, and I probably say, you know what, we'll just run it back next season with our own draft pick. So, again, your teams that are probably standing pat are the Bucks, Bullets, Pacers, and Knicks. Your sellers, the 76ers, Hawks, and Pistons, and your buyers, I think, are the Celtics, Cavs, Bulls, and maybe the Nets. I don't think the Nets are going to be sellers. Whether or not they're going to be buyers really depends on what happens in this upcoming set. Going out west, you've got the Kings and the Trailblazers that are out in front of their divisions. The Nuggets are pushing the Kings. The Suns are pushing the Trailblazers. All of these teams are doing very, very well. The Jazz and the Warriors are still in it. The Mavericks are 500. The Lakers, after a very good start, have kind of fallen off. I think the Clippers, Spurs, Rockets, and Supersonics are the teams that I would definitively say are out of the race. And the only reason I say that is because the Clippers are going to have to climb over so many teams to get back in. I don't know that they can do it. And there are just a lot of really good teams ahead of them. I think the Kings are fine where they are. The Blazers are fine where they are. The Nuggets and Suns are fine where they are. The Jazz, now that Kiki Vandeweghe is healthy, are showing what they can really do. I think they're probably going to stay put. The Warriors are an interesting case. They started well. They've kind of slipped a little bit recently. But again, that could be attributed to injury. Mike Mitchell, a name not a lot of us have heard of, but he has missed some time for them. James Bailey has missed some time for them, and those guys average 20 and 10 points respectively. So I suspect the Warriors like their chances once they get healthy. That said, I can imagine a scenario where the Warriors want to get a little bit deeper and will pull the trigger on a move. The Lakers, we know all season, have been looking for a power forward. If they can find it, I fully expect them to pull the trigger on that. If they can't, I think they could be sellers. We know that they've been shopping World Be Free, and they've been shopping Jamal Wilkes for some time. Obviously, Kelly Tripucka is the future in the backcourt there. I think they're happy with James Donaldson and Brad Davis for now. So if the Lakers can find a buyer, they'll probably move one of those guys. I think they would prefer to be a buyer, but I think they're going to wind up forced to be a seller because everybody is looking for a power forward, and I don't know that they have or they're willing to give up something as attractive as some of those teams that need a power forward in the Eastern Conference. That kind of leaves us with the Mavericks as the team that's kind of in the middle, and this is another team where I could see them going either way. I know they've been shopping Dan Issel. He's a little bit older. George Gervin at 29 is a little bit older. Their only really young piece is Johnny Moore. So I think if the Mavericks can't find a deal that they feel makes them contenders now, it's probably the ideal time for them to pull the ripcord on this season. They're currently sitting seventh, but they're 3.5 games back of the Warriors. If they can close the gap again over the next sim, I think they decide to stay in it. If that gap stays the same or widens, I think they're going to bail out. So the Mavericks and Lakers could go either way, but if they don't find a trade very, very soon or close ground in this coming sim, I think both of them wave the white flag on this season. So I really think the West playoff teams are kind of set. I think it's going to be the Kings, Blazers, Nuggets, Suns, Jazz, and Warriors. Although, again, the Mavericks or the Lakers could make a big trade to sneak in there. I just don't think they will. Clippers, I know they have the same record as the Lakers, but when I look at their differential, it's closer to the Spurs differential. They're at minus 4.3 on average. The Spurs are minus 4.4. The Rockets are minus 3. So their record may just be the result of a lot of close wins. And, again, I've said in the past that when I look for my expectation on future performance, one of the things I pay close attention to is that point differential column. And that to me is the longer term indicator of how a team's going to do. And it's why, I think the Suns are going to push the Trailblazers, for example, in the Pacific Division. Right now, the Suns have an 8.4. The Blazers have a 6.6, which tells me to this point in the season, even if the record doesn't reflect it, the Suns on average have been the better team. The Nuggets, I think, will have a hard time tracking down the Kings, although I will point out, just like I was a little bit, I guess maybe not as high on the Celtics as some other people are, I'm not as high on the Kings as their record might indicate, because they've had 25 home games and 20 road games. And eventually that's going to even out, and as that evens out, that's going to bring them back to the pack. They're only 2.5 games ahead of the Nuggets, and when you look at their road record, you can expect them to give at least 2 of those games back. So in my mind, they're kind of in a virtual tie with the Nuggets in terms of quality of wins so far, just because they've had more home games. Now, they've done a good job defending home court, but eventually they're going to have to go on the road. And I think that's when the Nuggets can make their move to catch up. That said, the Kings' point differential is such that right now I think they have the inside track to win the division. So there you have it. Who do I think are your buyers at the trade deadline? I think it would be those teams kind of in the middle. Again, the Lakers, Mavericks, maybe the Warriors in the West, possibly the Jazz, but I don't think they have assets they want to give up. In the East, I think the Celtics, Cavaliers, Bulls, and maybe the Nets are your buyers. I think the Mavericks could become sellers. The Lakers could become sellers. I don't think the other teams that I mentioned could become sellers. The Nets aren't going to sell. They're just going to stand pat. And then, you know, your selling teams, I'd say the 76ers, Hawks, Pistons, Spurs, Rockets, and Supersonics. But the Supersonics have already basically sold off all their assets. I think they're sitting on 6 first, maybe not 6 first, but 6 draft picks this season. Let me double check here. Yes, they're absolutely sitting on 6 draft picks this season. They have 3 draft picks the season after that. They're clearly following the Sam Presti model of ownership, where you just try to get all the draft picks. I could be remembering wrong, but I think there might be a limitation in Fast Break that does not allow you to accumulate more than 6 total draft picks in any given year, and that's first and second rounders. So it's probably a good thing they're drafting all of their picks, or their 6 picks this season, because if they tried to get more, they might not be allowed to do that. So that's where we're at. Obviously, the future in Seattle is Lewis Lloyd and Danny Ainge. It'll be curious to me anyway to see what they put around them. I know they're hanging on to Danny Shays right now. He's still very raw. I don't know if he's going to be their long-term solution. But as far as the trade deadline goes, I have to think at least one of these teams that I identified as a buyer is going to take a shot. I don't think there's anybody that looks like they're the absolute favorites to win it. Maybe the Bucks. I mean, yeah, they're double-digit point differential is exceptional. But nobody is just absolutely crushing souls and hopes and dreams. I think even some of the top-tier teams, the Bullets, Pacers, Knicks, they could take a trade to try to catch the Bucks. And as we saw in the playoffs last year, it can come down to matchups. I don't think anybody thinks that any of the teams, Kings, Blazers, Bucks, or Bullets, that's currently leading their divisions are, pardon the pun, bulletproof. So I do think there's at least one and possibly 2 blockbusters that are going to happen between now and the trade deadline. So that's my, we'll make the over-under 1.5. I would lean toward 2, but I think it could just be 1. I don't think it'll be 0. Somebody is going to get antsy and pull the trigger. So there you have it. That's my thoughts on both depth charts, game planning, and on who our buyers and sellers are coming to the trade deadline. We'll wrap it up, and we'll see everybody following the trade deadline and maybe some early playoff previews, but hopefully I'll have some trades to react to.